one of the most kind of fascinating or imagination-grabbing aspects of martial arts for people is this concept of breaking boards, right? That somebody can put their elbow or their knee through, you know, a board or two boards or three boards. Everybody's fascinated by that. So I kind of hate to let everybody in on the trick, but it's really just a trick of physics. Any of you who probably have taken some martial arts or know physics know that that's all it is. It's a physics trick. So the reason that when you rank up in terms of testing for your next belt, at least for me, that you would do that is not to see how cool you can look. It's to see if you understand the mechanics of how to move. You understand the mechanics of the art that you're being taught. So to reach your black belt, what you have to do, at least what I had to do, was a running, jumping sidekick, which would look really cool in a movie, but wouldn't be very practical at all for self-defense. And you'd jump over about two or three people into this board and break it. So there's a lot of moving pieces to keep track of. You have to kind of have a sense of like what your stride is and how many strides back you need to be. You need to know when to jump so you don't land on or step on these people who are putting their bodies on the line for your belt. And then you need to know when to release the kick so that you hit the board at the right time with the right force. And then you need to know how to go through it and land properly so you don't make a mess of yourself and the people who are holding the board. If you've done martial arts long enough, that's not that hard to do, but I saw plenty of people either bounce off the board or hurt themselves hitting the board wrong. Because there's another piece to this. You have to be convicted when you start those strides that you're going to go through that board. You have to be convicted that you know what you're supposed to do so that you can follow through on what you've now started. And if you lack that conviction, you're going to lack that thing that ties all of the other pieces together and makes it successful. And so this question of conviction runs through the readings this weekend. St. Paul says, if God is for us, then who can be against us? What a beautiful statement. What a beautiful truth. But do we believe that it is in fact the truth? Do we believe that God is for us? We believe on some level God's for us. Yeah, he's a nice guy, he's good, okay, he probably wants what's best for me. But do we believe in our bones, are we convicted that what God desires, what God works for each of us in the tiny, intimate, even unknown details of our life is in fact our good? I think oftentimes that's where it sort of falls apart. We can begin this journey of faith. We can have all the pieces kind of moving, but if that doesn't unite them, if our trust in the goodness of God is not there, it's very difficult for us to follow through. So it gives some context to this very bizarre, perhaps disturbing first reading. What kind of God would ask for the sacrifice of his son? And Abraham is rewarded for his willingness to murder an innocent? To kill this gift that God's given to him? Obviously, for people of faith, we should get the sense there's something else going on. Because this isn't about our God. This is about all of the other gods and goddesses that the people who knew this story, the ancient Israelites, would have heard this story and known that our God is different from the gods and goddesses of the people around us. Because that's exactly what the gods and goddesses and cultures around them were like. The highest form of sacrifice, the highest way of manipulating, of controlling these gods, was giving the blood of your own offspring, ritual human child sacrifice. It's barbaric, but in their minds it was logical. It made sense. Because the gods and goddesses were not good, they didn't stand with and for their people. At best, they didn't care. At worst, they were opposed and needed to be appeased by that which was most precious to these insignificant humans who worshiped them. And so, ritual child sacrifice was a thing. So this story is not about the cruelty of our God demanding a sacrifice. Notice Abraham doesn't really bat an eye. There's some level where he still doesn't understand who God is, and so he's like, well, okay, I guess this is kind of what we're doing. But Then God says, okay, enough. I am more generous than that. I am for you, and you do not need to give me the blood of your child. I will not be manipulated or controlled by that or anything else, because I am already good. I am already for you. I am already generous, so generous that I've already provided the sacrifice that I want. And I will continue to do that down the ages until he does give his own beloved son. God is already for us. And so this story is in fact about God expanding the horizons, expanding the mind and the heart and the imagination of his people to see just how good he is. And so the gospel, we see him stretching them even further, because they don't get bogged down in, did you just see what happened? Did you see how amazing that was? Did you see what he looked like? They're debating, what does it mean for somebody to rise from the dead? It sounds like a really odd, kind of missing the point sort of moment. But for the Jews of that time, that's an important question, because the belief in the resurrection, the belief in an afterlife, is really not universal. They don't know what this means. They have a concept that God is good to them in this life, and that that looks like something. But an afterlife, a reality beyond death, coming back from that final end, doesn't make a lot of sense to them, and so it's mysterious. But we see this story is about God again saying, I am about more than just getting you good in this life. That glory that I showed you in my son, who I told you to listen to, I want you to have that glory. I want you to be caught up into it and transformed. That is my desire for you. And so we see again, God is about expanding the hearts, the minds, the imagination of his people to desire all that he desires to give. He is for us. He doesn't need us to try and control him or to manipulate him or to do any number of things to sort of get what we want. He's already for us. And so we need to surrender. Surrender those ways that we do try and manipulate and control God. And we all know them, because they all flow from this same doubt that God might not actually want what's best for me. God might not actually be for me. So maybe we see that in our finances and the temptation to greed. God, I know that you're good, and I know I'm supposed to give to the poor. But financial security, it's an important thing. Because you might not be good, and you might leave me in the lurch if things go south with the economy. So I'm going to ignore those who actually need my excess. Because you might not be good, God. Or in the way that we approach immigration, people from other countries. I know I'm supposed to look for you in the stranger, God, but you know, those people from other countries, they can be dangerous, they can be connected to a drug trade, they can be any number of things, and so you may not keep us safe. So I know what you say, but I'm taking my way. I know marriage is about being fruitful and turning my life over to you through my spouse, but you might not actually be good. You might end up with too many kids or things kind of out of control. So, you know, my way, not yours, because you might not actually be good. God, I know that you would call me to let go of some of these friends who are leading me down the wrong road. But what if you just leave me lonely instead? What if there is no good on the other side of that sacrifice? So I'm going to stay with them, come what may, because you might not actually be good. And we do this over and over and over again, either with our thoughts, our feelings, with our opinions, with our actions. We say, God, I don't actually believe that you're fully good, that you're fully with me, because this sacrifice that you may ask me to make, this surrender to you, may not actually be for my good, but it might destroy me, because I don't believe that you actually are for me. And God desires to stretch our minds, our hearts, our imaginations to receive the beauty of his goodness, but we have to trust him. We have to trust when he challenges us in the scripture or through the voice of his bride in the church, when he challenges us in the needs of those that we love. He's not looking to wipe us out, to ask for what's most precious to us, but to give us what ought to be most precious to us, which is his own life, his glory. He's looking to transfigure us. So as we approach him today in the Eucharist, as we do each week, we don't see God transfigured. We don't see that blinding goodness that no fuller on earth could recreate. We see what looks like bread and wine, but we know to be the very thing that transforms us, the very person who transforms us. Jesus, hidden from our sight, but no less powerful, desiring to consume us, even as we consume him, in his glory. Perhaps we need to trust the Lord and go into reconciliation that, you know, yeah, it just feels like an uncomfortable encounter with Father John or Father Aaron. But beyond that, if I let God stretch my mind and my imagination, it's coming to the foot of that cross and seeing the divine mercy laid bare for me. Or, I know I should pray, but those 20 minutes, or, Father, you know, you're busy, all that time that I should be responding to email or writing, I know I should pray, but God, maybe if I don't get this done, you're not going to be good and not going to take care of me. No, spend that time with him. Be willing to let your mind, your heart, your imagination be expanded so that the glory of God might consume it. And so today, as we do approach our hidden Lord in the Eucharist, ask him, give me the faith to see, to believe your goodness, that you are for me, that you are with me, that you are absolutely good and desire to draw me to your glory, no matter what comes, no matter what you might ask of me, that it is only ever for my good. So that what Peter, James, and John saw on that mountain is a glimpse of what you desire to give to me, to the person sitting next to me, to the person that I've never met on the other side of the world who also worships you. You are for me. Thank God for the gift of that sense and trust in his goodness. Brothers and sisters, God is for us. Who can be against us?